Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to part four of our 1970s odyssey, 1972-73. We move on to the season of Shankly's second great team, possibly the greatest FA Cup final shock of all time. Leeds United's capitulation on three fronts, Arsenal throwing a potential double away, relegation for a team dear to one of our contributors' hearts, and all manner of chaos across the breadth of the 1972-73 season. Joining us, we have Dave Bowler. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening. It's good to be here. Looking forward to this one. There's some particularly great, despite the relegation, there's some particularly great moments to enjoy from this season, I think.
A pivotal season indeed. And in the other side of my screen, it's Gary Thacker joining us. Good evening, Gary.
Hi, guys. Yeah, great to be on board for this episode. This is the year that Ajax won their third European Cup title as well. So, yeah, it's great year for football. Great year for football. So I'm looking forward to a great chat about some of the events. You mentioned about, you know, the Cup upset, but there's so much other stuff to talk about this year as well. So, yeah, looking forward to it, guys.
Oh, there is indeed. There's no shortage of intrigue about this season. But I think we have to rip the plaster off, I think, with 1972-73. We do have to weigh straight into Sunderland. You know, they were the big story of the season, no matter what anyone else did. And I say that from a Liverpool supporting perspective, where a seven-year itch has finally scratched this season. But Dave, Sunderland, I mean, it's not just about Wembley. It's not just Bob Stoke over and across the pitch and Ian Porterfield's winner and, you know, Jim Montgomery with that ludicrous double save that he makes, to go along with several other fantastic stops as well that day. But it's the fact that they dispense with Manchester City en route, they dispense with Arsenal en route. To have lightning strike once is one thing, but three times, there was a little bit more than just luck behind this cup run. I mean, wind assisted isn't right, but when it's your year, it's your year. I think that the no better example of the theory than this season.
In the first of these episodes, the first of the series, I did say that the 1969-70 Cup Final is the greatest Cup Final of all time, which I stand by. But this is pretty damn close. I mean, that Cup Final was astonishing. But as you say, they did it the hard way. They beat some proper teams on the way there. It wasn't that they got lucky with the draw or anything like that. It was a great cup run, and I think, looking at it from our perspective now, you know, 50 years on, literally 50 years on, I think it shows how the game has changed. Because that Sunderland team, it got some proper players in it. I mean, you know, you're not going to win the FA Cup without some proper players. But they were in the second division, and they've got people of the quality of Dave Watson and Dennis Stewart in that team, Ian Porterfield as well. And I know they moved on ultimately, but in this day and age, there's no way they'd be in that team. And if they were in that team, it would only be because they're on loan from Spurs or Chelsea or, you know, somebody like that. So I think that's a big difference. And yeah, when we come on to the relegations later on about, you know, talk about West Brom and stuff, the big thing was when you went down, you kept your team. It wasn't that there was a sudden mass exodus. You kept your team. And yeah, because the first division teams, they didn't have squads, did they? I mean, you know, when we come on to Liverpool winning the league, they probably won with 14 players really that season, you know, and a couple of extras on top of that. So if you wanted to play, you went into the second division, you played. And I think the standard of that division was higher, and Sunderland proved that, because I mean, they didn't get promoted that season, but they were a really strong team. They knew what they were doing, and they got some really good players in there. Hughes, Bobby Carey was a good player, you know, and of course with Dennis Stewart and Dave Watson, as I said, you know, you got guys who went on to become England regulars, you know, two or three years down the line, fully deserving of what they did. And I think that's one of the things that pains me most about the way football has gone, is that lack of strength in depth down the divisions. You know, second division teams have course, it remains a rare thing for a second division club to have, or a championship club now, to have won the FA Cup. But it was possible in those days because they were a closer playing field to what was going on in the first division. There were a lot of very good teams in the second division at that point, which I don't think is quite so much the case now, which is a shame. But yeah, I mean that the cup final especially. I mean, there's, you know, you've gone through them, but those are iconic moments that'll go on forever in the FA Cup. The Bob Stokoe run, the Montgomery save. But yeah, I mean, those are the great moments in the FA Cup. Same sort of thing as Ronnie Radford or whatever. They are the things that come to your mind when people talk about the FA Cup, aren't they?
Gary, Leeds had to have felt they'd done the hard work already. Four of the five teams that they played en route to Wembley were first division sides. Yeah. They'd taken on Ron Saunders, Norwich City, a team that he would take to Wembley for the League Cup final that year. West Brom, Derby County, a quarter win, a quarter final away at Derby County, and then Edge Wolves in the semi-finals, and that's the Wolves that had reached the UEFA Cup final the previous season. Yeah. You're Leeds United, you've put in some hard miles to reach Wembley, and then there's Sunderland. It's the golden ticket, surely.
You could say it's just typical Leeds of that era. You know, we seem to sort of always fall at the last hurdle, always find one team that's going to sort of deny them their just deserves, as it were. It's interesting. I remember this, and you know, this is one of the benefits of being quite old. The ITV used to do a thing before the cup final called Who Will Win the Cup. This was on the Friday before the Saturday of the cup final, and it was Brian Moore hosting. He's got some pundits, you know, but, and Jack Charlton was on there, and for some weird reason, they did all of this, look at the defence, the goalkeeper, the midfield and forwards, and they came to the conclusion, they did points for all these different things, that Sunderland would win the cup. Found out, and I remember Jack Charlton being incandescent with rage about saying, this is stupid. I mean, how can this be right? But again, strangely enough, it wasn't. The thing with that run to the cup for Sunderland, Bob Stokoe gets all the credit. But, you know, I've got a friend who lives quite near to me over here who's, bless his cotton socks, he's 18 there, so he remembers this really well. That was Alan Brown's team that got to that the run. He took them a long way, and Stokoe sort of dipped it at the end, a bit like, you know, Rinus Mikkels taking over to go to the World Cup finals or, you know, after somebody else has done all the hard work qualification. So, yeah, so it was a weird thing, but Leeds has got this thing about they could always find a way not to win what you think they were going to win. They almost seemed to find a way of falling short for some strange reason. And this was just another occasion. As you say, it was the golden ticket, you know. It's almost like a buy to winning the FA Cup, and they fell down again.
Incredible, Dave. I mean, they are one of the two teams that keep pace in the title race with Liverpool across the span of the season. They reached the Cup Winners' Cup final. And I know Leeds fans, certainly of a certain age, lament the 1975 European Cup final as being the one that was crooked. The 73 Cup Winners' Cup final. Now, I think even Milan themselves kind of like don't defend themselves anymore on that one. This is a season where Leeds have gone for a treble and come up with nothing in the end. But, you know, what an effort, though.
We've said this over the previous three episodes, I think. At that era, I think Leeds were the best team in England. By a street, actually. Going back to what I was saying earlier, but, you know, they didn't have squads. And I think, you know, we saw year after year and again in this season, by the time they got to that final 5-6 weeks of the season, they were running on empty, you know. I mean, even now, you can pretty much name that Leeds team from that era. You know, there's 11 players, and then Paul Madeley fits in somewhere, depending on who's suspended or injured that week. And that's pretty much it. Mick Bates would occasionally get a game. And then by the time we get to here, I think Trevor Cherry's in at left-back for Terry Cooper, who broke his leg and was never quite the same player again. But, yeah, they ran out of steam. But, I mean, it is interesting, the Cup Winners' Cup thing in this year, of all years, because Bob Stokoe hated Dunriver. Because, you know, he always professed that when he first went into management at Bury, as Leeds were going for promotion from the second division, he always says that Revy, or he always said, well, he's not saying much now, he always said that Revy offered him 500 quid to take it easy in that game. Bob Stoker was outraged by this, and he always bore a grudge to Revy over all the years. So if that's true, I suppose in a sense it's a bit of poetic justice that Sunderland took the cup off him. But I mean, yeah, that's the downside of Don Revy, because he was always, again, we've said this before, but you know, the superstitions and the nervousness about it. And there was no need to be nervous about that Leeds team. I mean, my God, they were the best. Quite simply, and if he'd given them, you know, when we were coming to next season, the 73-14, when they finally got their head a bit, they absolutely decimated the first division. And a bit more of that, and Leeds would probably have ended up with 6 or 7 more pots than they got.
Gary, this back to Sunderland, the 1970s across the board for them is peculiar. I mean, this by the time 1972-73 comes along, this is their third season down in the second division since relegation in 1969-70. Even winning the FA Cup, they'd still take another 3 years to return to the first division. They would go down in acrimony at the first time of asking and would take another 3 years to return. So they spent all but one season of the 1970s in the second division. Yet this cup success, you know, just stands there as a monument to A, what you can do with a team that is dysfunctional, but also, you know, the history involved as well, because they were the first team to win the FA Cup from outside the top flight since 1931, when a certain West Bromwich Albion did so.
Did
their own double, yes. This Sunderland, is it the greatest upset of all time in the FA Cup final? I mean, I'd say that it's a difficult one to call, because Sunderland have such a proud history. And in a way, you know, they had a prouder history than Leeds United did at that point in time. But in contemporary 1973 terms, the chasm between the two was enormous.
It's a really weird one, that is, Stevie. I mean, you know, you look back and you sort of take 20 years off that, and Sunderland are a massive team and Leeds are a pretty average second-tier club. So, yeah, Sunderland have a sort of, by far, a greater history than Leeds when you look back more distance, you take a longer perspective. But, you know, as you say, you know, Leeds were one of the dominant teams of English football of that era. And Sunderland were, you know, I mean, they missed out promotion that year by, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 points. They certainly weren't even close to getting promotion that season. And as you said, you know, they sort of spent time before that and after that in the second tier, got up, fell down again, and seemed to have that, you know, and the team you look at, and Dave mentioned this, you know, you got Jim Montgomery, Porterfield, Dave Watson went to do great things with Man City, did his Tuart. They had a really decent team, Bobby Kerr, and yet they didn't seem to have that ability to string it together for a league season, and this was just one of those things where everything fell into place. But as you said earlier, you know, they didn't, it's not as if they had an easy run to the final, the beat City after replay, and they beat Arsenal, they said they'd fallen as well. So, you know, it wasn't, there was no gimme there. It just seemed to be everything that dropped into place. And sometimes these things are written. And when you're looking for, you know, the great cup final upsets, and this weren't far short, and it wasn't the best, but it wasn't far short. Sometimes these things are written in advance, and you know, it just seemed that no matter what Leeds did, and I remember that double save from Montgomery, and David Coleman was commentating, and he said, the ball hadn't gone in there, but he thought it had. It was just one of those, I say, you know, sometimes these things are written, and it just wasn't Leeds' day that day, and, you know, it was Sunderland's, and I just, you know, as I say, you know, you guys just alluded to it, Leeds fell over their feet on the final hurdle, summertime, you know, Leeds United, Devon Lock United almost.
An amazing final, an amazing situation. Across the broader spectrum, back to the first division, Dave, Liverpool, they managed to scratch that 7-year itch. It's 7 years since they've won a major trophy. There have been a few near misses in the previous two seasons. The title by, you know, denied it by a disallowed goal at Highbury. They'd lost the 1971 FA Cup final. There'd been a gradual progression. What is often referred to as Shank's second great team although I'd argue it was his third. His first one was the promotion winning team of S61-62. There are quite a few changes by the time they're winning double league titles and an FA Cup in the mid-60s. But this team has finally grown into itself. And 72-73, they're always at least toe-to-toe with Arsenal and Leeds, and then eventually they've got the legs to pull away with the title.
I think this is certainly a great side. It kind of gets a little bit overshadowed, I think, by what then came three or four years down the line with when Bob Paisley took over and obviously the European Cup win and all that followed. But, I mean, it was a terrific side. And people, I guess, kind of forget that, Larry Lloyd was in that team. Brian Hall gets overlooked a little bit. Peter Cormack gets overlooked a little bit. But that was a really powerful Liverpool team, I thought, at that time. When it came to the crunch in the back end of February, they put together 8 wins in 10 games to just ease away. Because it had been dead tight the whole league, hadn't it, up until sort of February. And then Liverpool just put the foot on the gas and accelerated away, as we were become used to over the following 15 years, pretty much. That was, they were really coming onto it there. And they were a great team to watch as well. That Liverpool side, I always thought. Probably the zenith of that was to come the following year in the cup final, when they just absolutely dismantled Newcastle in that game. But it was coming, as you say, for Liverpool. I mean, that sort of first sight of that team came in 71 in that FA Cup final against Arsenal, where they were, they ran Arsenal pretty close as Arsenal were going for the double. Close again the following year in the league, and then this time they were ready. I mean, yeah, the Keegan-Toshack partnership up front was a classic that the teams tried to emulate for about the next 25 years, I think, with going through to, I suppose, Quinn and Phillips was the last evidence of that, going back to Sunderland. But they got such strength all the way through that team. Emlyn Hughes was in his prime, and Tommy Smith, Larry Lloyd, as I said earlier, was a terrific centre-half. I mean, he won loads of medals at Liverpool, left, and then went and did the same at Nottingham Forest a bit later on. Ray Clements was coming to his peak I think he was a better goalkeeper than Peter Shilton, but there we are. It's a proper debate we'll have on Mount Rushmore at some point in the future. But, but I think he was at that point, he was the best goalkeeper certainly the best English goalkeeper in the first division. They were just a team that had got everything. I always felt that Liverpool team, you'd have got the energy, you'd have got the intelligence, you'd have got a bit of guile, you'd still got Ian Callaghan still in his sort of peak years. And Keegan was really becoming the star of the show in terms of English football. So it was a fully deserved league title. And as I say, I just think it's a shame that team gets a little bit overshadowed by what came before with Shankly's first two great teams. And then, obviously, all the European exploits that followed, but I think it's up there with any of the Liverpool teams.
I mean, Gary, Emlyn Hughes is a player that was so, I don't know, the dynamo of this team. I mean, at this point in time, he's still playing his football for Liverpool in central midfield alongside Ian Callaghan. This is before his switch. He drops back into central defence the following season, really. There's been once or twice when he's filled the role, but he's still the marauding central midfielder at this point, while being England's number one left back, a position that he hadn't fulfilled at Liverpool since his early days at the club in 66-67, and wouldn't do again in a red shirt until the tail end of his career after the emergence of Alan Hansen. Hughes was just such a force of nature within that respect. And I think, Shankly had so much admiration for him. A lot of talk of Keegan, but Hughes's part in this side tends to be, it falls under the radar, certainly outside the umbrella of kind of Liverpool watchers and Liverpool supporters.
Yeah, you're right, mate. I mean, at this sort of stage of Liverpool's sort of development, he almost epitomised the team. It was sort of, a player of great skill, application, boundless energy, but almost above all, that belief that you were always going to win, that determination, that conviction that, you know, Liverpool were going to win. It's interesting, you mentioned Callaghan there, you know, as Dave did. And, you know, this guy was sort of, you know, we talk about Shankly's second team. I mean, this guy came forward and still played, still performed brilliantly, you know, in the sort of second incarnation of Shankly's team. And obviously, this was Shankly's last but one season. I think he retired at the end of the following season. And yeah, I've looked at the table. It's interesting, you know, because Arsenal, you know, look, Arsenal won them close, but he's just 3 points behind. But, you know, I just think Arsenal had a really strange season there. I mean, they finished 3 points behind Liverpool, but they scored, only scored 57 goals in 42 games to finish second. And then they conceded one more goal than Liverpool. But, you know, they scored the same amount of goals as City, who finished 11th, and four goals less than Stoke, who finished 16th. 15th to 16th. So you look at that Arsenal team and you think that they were in Liverpool close, but really were they that close? I mean, in terms of performances, you know, it just seems like almost like a chasm, 3 points, but almost a ginormous chasm between the two, because that Liverpool team, they were on the cusp of being Europe, you know, they're going to dominate Europe in the next few years. And Arsenal never really had that sort of kick on from there. They seemed to sort of, I won't say meander downwards, but certainly didn't kick on the same way as Liverpool did.
Hey Dave, Arsenal though, as part of this race, I mean, they Leeds losing to Sunderland in the FA Cup final kind of shades the way that Arsenal just didn't even compete in that semi final against them, not properly. There seemed to be I don't know. You look at the footage and read the reports, and it was very much Sunderland's game, you know. Whereas the final, there is a period of it where Sunderland are very much backs against the wall. You know, there's glaring errors in defence as part of that semi-final defeat, but to fall away in the title race as well, you know, this is the season that kind of marks Arsenal's decline until certainly the end game of Bertie Mee's reign. You know, Terry Neill would come in and rejuvenate things, certainly in a cup, you know, cup chasing kind of manner. But this is the last Arsenal side to truly challenge for a league title until they win it and gain themselves in 88-89.
Gary says the significant thing with Arsenal, they let 43 goals in. For that Arsenal team of that era, was very un-Arsenal. I think they kept faith with the same team for too long. I think too many of those players were coming towards the end. I mean, Frank McClintock was still in that team. And I mean, yeah, when they won the double 2 years earlier, everybody was saying, well, you know, this is a great last hurrah for Frank McClintock. And there he was another 2 years on, still holding the defence together. And he must have been, I don't know, 36, 37 at that point. Bob Wilson was still there. He was, you know, into his mid-late 30s as well. I mean, Liverpool had found this. It's very difficult when you've got a great side to break that side up and introduce new players, because they've done a lot for you. You know, there's all those relationships that go on between manager and player, and it's very difficult to find anybody who's any better. You know, if you've won the league, you've obviously got a pretty good side. So finding somebody who's going to come in and make that team better was a very difficult trick. And you know, I don't suppose we saw a team really master that and do it quickly until Liverpool began to do it in the late 70s and through into the 80s. I mean, Liverpool were able always to, you know, move a couple of players on every year and bring a couple more in that were hungry but were better as well. That was the great knack they had. And then obviously Manchester United did it in the Premier League era. I think Arsenal just stuck with what they'd got for too long. I mean, John Radford was still in that team. John Radford, a much underrated footballer. We saw a terrific centre forward. But again, you know, another 2 or 3 years on from that double winning team, and there was it was just decaying a bit. And that, you know, they finished second, they got to the FA Cup semi final. It's not a disastrous season, but in those, you know, in the final moments of the season, you could just see it beginning to decay. And they'd left it that bit too long, I think. And that was how it all sort of then began to go downhill for quite a while then for Arsenal, didn't it? I mean, there was no Arsenal title challenge again, really, of any substance for quite some time, another 10 years probably after that. But that's not, you know, that's to take nothing away from Liverpool. Liverpool were the class act that season, without a shadow of a doubt. And they proved that, you know, I mean, everybody's raving now as we record this in the rosy aftermath of Manchester City's treble. But, I mean, Liverpool went on and did the double that season. They won the UEFA Cup in that season at a point when, I mean, the UEFA Cup was probably harder to win than the European Cup at that stage because there were a few more teams from each country in it. And by and large, they were the coming teams. They were the teams that probably the previous season had finished second or third and were on their way to reaching the top. So, you know, Liverpool to come through and win that, win a first European trophy and to win the league in an era when it's a more level playing field than it is now for a Manchester City or a Real Madrid or, you know, a team with that kind of money. That's a fantastic achievement, I think. And Shankly should have had a peerage. Let's be honest about it.
He'd have turned it down, Dave. He'd have turned it down.
That's also true, but...
I mean, Gary, the Liverpool's UEFA Cup success this season to go hand in hand. It's the first time in English football that a club, managed to win the league title and pick off a European trophy within the same campaign. The teams that Liverpool got past along the way, Eintracht Frankfurt, AEK Athens, Dynamo Berlin, Dynamo Dresden, so back-to-back trips into East Germany, an all-English semi-final against the holders, Tottenham. And then the mighty Borussia Mönchengladbach over two legs in the final, Gunternetzer and everything that goes along with that side of Henners Weisweilers, Rainer Bonhoff, Bertie Vogts, Herbert Wimmer, Jupp Heynckes, Alan Simonsen, amongst all that, that is some achievement just winning the UEFA Cup that season, I think.
Yeah, definitely, Matt. And we spoke earlier about Leeds falling between. They fell between three stools. Well, Liverpool didn't. They didn't fall between the stools. They got the job done. And, you know, they won the league, as you say, and then first English team to win the league, and with a European trophy as well. And that European trophy is no gimme either. You mentioned, you know, even going to the last four and then the final, Spurs holders, no easy game. But that Borussia Mönchengladbach team, I mean, what a final that was. Two fantastic legs and... could have gone either way at the end. So, you know, all great sort of credit to Liverpool because, you know, they had to negotiate a lot of games that season. But they got the job done. But that was typical Liverpool and Leeds not doing it. It was typical Leeds at that time. It was just that mentality, I think, back to you mentioned about Emlyn Hughes. That was the sort of ethos that ran through that Liverpool team. They went out expecting to win. Leeds might have gone out hoping to win. Perhaps that's the sort of difference between, you know, getting their hands on the trophy and finishing with a silver medal.
It's hard to judge, though, of Bill Shankly's greatest achievements as Liverpool manager. Certainly post, you know, taking the team out of the second division, you know, build them up from you know, nothing, basically. The mid-60s team, that wonderful FA Cup final flourish in 74. 73, you're right, it does, 72, 73 does fall under the radar, you know, to a large degree. But, you know, there's an argument there to be made that it is his finest vintage.
I think there is. I mean, we could have a discussion about Bill Shankly for about the next 5 hours. I think Bill Shankly's greatest achievement was that, unlike all the others, unlike, you know, Alex Ferguson and Matt Busby and all the other ones, Bill Shankly built a football club rather than a football team. And when Bill Shankly went, Liverpool carried on. And that doesn't happen with other football managers, you know, I mean, Brian Clough, Don Revie, Busby, Ferguson, they go and the football club starts to fall apart, starts to decay, and they don't maintain that level of success where I think, you know, Shankly built Liverpool in such a way in the boot room and all of that kind of stuff. And the symbiosis with the supporters as well, which is, I think, far more important at Liverpool than any of those other clubs. I think that was his greatest achievement, was to build this, you know, this bastion that would go on forever. But in terms of his teams, I think that 73 one was a fabulous team. And to beat Borussia Mönchengladbach, I mean, that side was a bit special, that side that they had. They got a bit of luck with the first leg being called off after 20-odd minutes when the rain came, and then John Toshack was suddenly in the team the following night when they played it again, and Toshack made the difference. But I think that was a that was a magnificent team. And there was a lot of that that ultimately would go on to be, you know, part of Bob Paisley's side that would then go on and rule over Europe, really, for the next sort of 6-7 years after Shankly had gone. So I think this is a proper special Liverpool team, for, you know, for all the great teams that they've had over the many years, you know. And even in more recent times, I think this is a proper special Liverpool team.
I just mentioned about Leeds sort of missing out. There's a little sort of North London sob story as well. Arsenal finished second in the league and yet didn't qualify for European competition because of UEFA's one club, one city, and obviously Tottenham won the League Cup and took the UEFA place away from them. Liverpool knocked Spurs out of took the UEFA Cup trophy away from them. So North London was sort of, you know, sucking on lemons as well as perhaps Leeds were as well.
I mean, that was a peculiarity, wasn't it, Dave? I mean, it's second place. Tottenham did qualify for the UEFA Cup via winning the League Cup, that League Cup final. So for Arsenal, yeah, to finish second and not even get European football for the following season, and Spurs from eighth getting there, you know, it was a ludicrous affair, and that UEFA Cup concept of carried over from the first cup of only having one team per city. It wasn't until 75 that was reluctantly by UEFA pushed aside.
It is a bizarre kind of concept, isn't it? I suppose they wanted to spread the game around a bit and let other cities have a look. Perhaps we ought to come back to that kind of thing now. It'd be give some of the rest of us a bit of a chance. But no, I mean, it's ludicrous because if you finish second, you go to the UEFA Cup, don't you? I mean, it's absolute nonsense that you were robbed of it by a team in your city again. Let's try and tell Manchester United they're not in the Champions League next season because Manchester City are there. let's see how that plays.
Oh, indeed. Are you talking about Manchester United? We'll move on to our great underachievers of 1972-73. Along with our projected overachievers, we'd like to have a look at these in the previous couple of episodes. Ipswich Town are starting to become the Bobby Robson Ipswich Town that we would all know. Fourth place finish with UEFA Cup qualification, going in alongside Wolves, who finished a point behind on 47, finishing in fifth place. West Ham United finished sixth. Pop Robson scored a bucket full of goals this season. Derby missed out on Europe in seventh as defending champions as rancor began to set in a little bit for Brian Clough. At the baseball ground, there's footage that I was watching earlier in the day of him, you know, threatening to move his team, himself, his chairman, lock, stock and barrel to somewhere else because Derby didn't deserve them. Yeah, just typical Clough fodder in that respect. In terms of underachievement, I'm sorry, Dave, but we will come to West Brom in a little bit. But Manchester United 18th, Everton 17th, Everton Park Company with Harry Kattrick. Later in the season, ill health finally bringing his time at Goodison to an end. Manchester United Park Company with Franco Farrell after a difficult start to the season, replaced by Tommy Doherty. And Manchester City slumped to mid-table as well with Malcolm Alisson making his exit. And for you, Gary, I'll throw Chelsea into the mix there as well, finishing 12th position, but mitigating circumstances because they seem to start the season quite well. There's a run to the quarterfinals of the FA Cup in which they are leading 2-1 against Arsenal and concede an atrocious equaliser, which takes the game to a hybrid replay and sees Arsenal go through instead. In a way, a projected second Leeds-Chelsea final, FA Cup final, was denied history, although it would have stopped the magnificence of Sunderland in that respect. Gary, our underachievers and our overachievers of 1972-73.
Well, Chelsea, just on the way to relegation, strangely enough, not too far down the road from there. But yeah, just touching on some of the, I mean, obviously you mentioned about Ipswich, obviously Bobby Robson has been there since 69, I think so. The team is shaping up, and I think Trevor Weimark was notching goals in for that season. I think he scored 15, 16 goals for them, and they won the Texaco Cup as well, I think, that year. So they were on the way up, and the other team that qualified, you mentioned, and this was because of Arsenal not qualifying. that UEFA Cup sort of situation then extended to Wolves, who finished fifth, getting that UEFA Cup place. And as you mentioned, they'd won the they were runners up in the UEFA Cup the year before.
Sorry, I'm just throwing in FA Cup semi-finalist that very season as well. I'd only narrowly beaten by Leeds in that FA Cup semi-final.
Correct, yeah. And they'd won the Texaco Cup the year before, and the following year they'd win the League Cup, and this was Bill McGarry's Wolves at the time. And it's interesting that, you know, looking at those two teams who sort of overachieved, Ipswich went on and Wolves didn't. Wolves, very much like we talk about Liverpool and Arsenal, you know, when they that sort of like most parting of the ways, one team goes on and prospers. And I won't say Wolves disappeared, but they sort of didn't do particularly well. You mentioned about Man United, they were very much like Ferguson after the post-Ferguson era. Who's going to replace him? We were still in the post-Matt Busby, who's going to replace him. Man United picked several people, and Frank O'Farrell that took from Leicester just never seemed to have that ability to be a big club manager. That it needed a personality at Manchester United, and I just think he hadn't got it. And there was a couple of teams, and you know, well, I'll let Dave talk about West Brom at the end because I don't want to sort of to be accused of getting my magic kicking. So I'll let him talk about West Brom.
Before we get to West Brom, Dave, I mean, Gary flags a really interesting point there. The divergences here of Ipswich and Wolves. I mean, Wolves are relegated three seasons later via winning the League Cup in 74, but the loss by, you know, we'll come to that further down the series. But then you've got the trajectory of Ipswich, which takes them to, you know, a chase for the double within a couple of seasons. The FA Cup success of 78, you know, the chase for a treble in 81, a league title that many believe should have been theirs in 81. Disservice to Aston Villa there. Many apologies to Aston Villa fans. I don't buy into that. You know, you don't win the title by accident or by default at all. You just have some seasons where maybe more than one team would have been worthy champions. But yeah, you know, it is an interesting divergence between the two clubs from here.
It is. I mean, yeah, the other thing that Ipswich had got at the start of that season was Kevin Beattie's first season. And I mean, he was a fantastic player. Had it not been for injuries, I mean, he would have gone on and played 50, 60 games, 70 games for England, for sure. And he was just, I think, you know, Ipswich had the advantage of being a little bit out of the spotlight by virtue of being where they, you know, where they are in the country. They hadn't got the same spotlight on them as perhaps Wolves had got. And I think Bobby Robson was able to put that team together a little bit more quietly, without so much fanfare and so much pressure. And he was shrewd in the transfer market. I mean, the midway through that season, he beat Liverpool to David Johnson up front to play a centre forward, but got him out of Everton when Liverpool wanted him, and that was a big move for Ipswich at that point because he scored a lot of goals for them. I think as well as you go into the later part of the 70s, some clubs suffered because their stadiums were basically falling down. I mean, the Molyneux. But it wasn't the most salubrious football ground in England, shall we say, by the time we got to the late 70s. And, you know, Chelsea obviously suffered when they had to redevelop bits of Stamford Bridge, and Wolves were the same when they got into the business of redeveloping Molyneux. They spent a lot of money on that, and a lot of clubs at that time, when they built new stands, I mean, it was a standard thing, you build a new stand and you get relegated. You know, and I think that was one of the things that held Wolves back. I mean, there was quite a bit of infighting behind the scenes as well, I think. But yeah, you know, I think as well, it's always in this part of the world, you know, I think whether Gary will agree, but because there's four big clubs, you know, and you can also throw Coventry in at that time as well, I suppose, into the mix. They're always fighting for attention, and in the same way that you might celebrate the one that's doing well. If one of them's on the floor, everybody's queuing up to give him a bit of a kick in as well. And I think that happened to Wolves for a period in the 70s, and then even more so later on in the 80s when they went all the way down to the fourth division. But I think they suffered a bit from that. And I think Ipswich didn't have that same sort of pressure, and Bobby Robson was able to put it under the radar. And Ipswich had the sense to keep Bobby Robson in the job. Bill McGarry, as Gary says, went out there and won a couple of things, and then all of a sudden he's off. You know, you've got to look at the leadership of the football clubs, and whether, you know, we were talking about this on another podcast recently that West Ham should stick with David Moyes and that kind of stuff. I think sometimes, you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for. Perhaps Wolves in that sense were a bit too ambitious. Thought they could be a bit better and paid the price for it.
And going back to Chelsea, Gary, you know, I think a lot of people will look at 1971-72 and reaching the League Cup final against Stoke as being kind of like the last hurrah for that team of the late, that swaggering team of the late 60s, early 70s. But 72-73, you know, it is a bit of a near miss, isn't it, in a way? You know, that loss of an FA Cup semi-final, you know, it is a slight, I think a subtle sliding door rather than an obvious one.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think the team were in a little bit of decline then. I mean, Sexton had got this sort of reputation for being less than a perfect man manager. He fell out with Osgood, he fell out with Alan Hudson, who both left the club eventually. And I think the team by that stage were in, you know, they'd won the cup in 71, they'd won the European Cup Winners' Cup in 72, beat Real Madrid. You know, guys, they got to the League Cup final. So you think, when you look at that in cold hard terms, that looked like pretty good. But then, you know, when you look behind, pull the curtain back and have a little look behind what's going on, the team was sort of, they were in a decline, there's no doubt. And as I say, not long after relegation followed, it's a bit of a sad story, really, from, you know, FA Cup winners, you know, Cup winners, you say, losing the FA Cup semi-final. And then, you know, it just fell away. And I just think that sometimes, you know, a manager can be at a club too long. I think Sexton was there too long and it fell out with the star players. And, you know, once you lose the dressing room, you're in trouble, really.
I mean, Dave, it's a fascinating erosion, really. And you know, that happens to a few clubs in that respect. You look at Manchester United, you know, and we're kind of charting their progression towards eventual relegation of the following season. You know, and I'm enjoying that. I've got to put my hands up about that. But I find it fascinating in a kind of dot-to-dot kind of way as well. You know, it's kind of like from, you know, league champions 67 to the European Cup success of 68 and blowing the title on the final day as well that season to an FA, you know, European Cup semi-final lost in 69, losing both domestic cup semi-finals in 1970. You know, even as a team that is starting to decay and starting to fall apart somewhat, you know, there's still kind of, you know, those green shoots of recovery and it's just slightly out of reach. You know, I think is there another League Cup semi-final in 71? I think they run to the quarterfinals and you know, they lose out to Stoke. You know, I can't remember, there's one where there's a, I think, an unedifying loss to a third division club amongst all that as well. You know, there are these kind of like little moments that you look at and think, oh, there's the divergence of the road. There's the fork in the road that could have made such a massive difference. I mean, 72-73 shouldn't go underestimated in Manchester United's, you know, drop to a relegation the following season. You know, there is a point in time throughout 72-73 where that relegation could have come a year earlier than it did.
It's not dissimilar, I don't think, to Chelsea in a lot of ways. I think when a football club has got two or three players who are so, I don't know, not so much big, big isn't quite the word, but they sort of embody the football club, like Peter Osgood and Alan Hudson did a little bit, I think, at Chelsea, perhaps. And obviously you've got Bess Charlton Law at Manchester United. To move on from those players is a seismic thing. I mean, it rips the heart out of a football club, because they are the players that everybody comes to see. That's who you hand your money over for. You know, you come and see them, which is, you might love Ron Harris or Nobby Stiles, or you don't pay your money to see them. You pay to see Dennis Law, pay to see Peter Osgood. And when they go, or when they're starting to fail, it takes something away from the soul of the football club, I think. And it's not as easy with those blokes to just, oh, well, we'll go and get another one. I mean, firstly, Dennis Laws and Peter Osgood's don't grow on trees, do they? You know, for a start off, so finding one is pretty damn difficult. But even then, if you find somebody of the same quality, something is missing then from the heart of the team and from the spectators, from the supporters' sense of what their football club's about. And I think it's very existential here. If But I think there is something in that. You know, it chips away at the psychology of the football club and what you think you are, your sense of what your football club is. And I think Manchester United could not get away from that. I mean, had George Best been a more stable human being, well, perhaps he wouldn't have been such a great footballer, but let's just assume for a moment he would have been. If he'd been able to take on that responsibility that was coming with the demise of Dennis Law and Bobby Charlton, then perhaps Manchester United would have had a different kind of future. But you know, he couldn't do that, and they'd lost those three, never mind what else is going on around the rest of the team. They just couldn't find a way out of it. It's interesting, you know, I mean, I'd always thought that Tommy Docherty came in, and your memory plays tricks. I always thought he came in sort of late in the year that they got relegated. And of course he didn't. He came in this season, saved them from relegation, and then went down the following year. Now, in the modern era, Tommy Docherty doesn't get the chance to bring Manchester United back up again, doesn't go on and win the FA Cup. You know, he gets the push for having relegated him in his second season. So, I mean, that's an interesting point to come on to later on. But I do think when you've got players who sort of dwarf the football club, who actually are bigger than the football club, whatever people like to say about there's nobody bigger than the club. But when you've got people of that kind of charisma, I think you lose something existential about your football club, and that takes time to recover from.
I think great points indeed. Gary, this is a season in which there is a lot of turbulence in management, and so much more would come the following season as well. You know, Catrick's departure from Everton, you know, the churn at Manchester United, where since Matt Busby has stepped aside, you know, it's been McGuinness, it's been O'Farrell. Busby's come back to be caretaker beyond McGuinness and between O'Farrell, and then it's Docherty. Malcolm Allison is another of these suspects. You know, he departed Manchester City in late March. The season kind of killed by that FA Cup defeat by Sunderland in so many respects. And you know, he himself turns around and says that, you know, he just kind of like burnt himself out, but not burnt himself out enough to walk into Selhurst Park within a short day or two, who he is at the helm of as they are relegated at the end of 72-73. This is a hell of a season for Malcolm Allison.
I guess, you know, I put Allison in a similar situation to Dave Sexton. You know, he's the coach, he's not managers necessarily, and I think he was far better as a coach working under Joe Mercer at City, far more successful. But I suppose, you know, he wasn't the next step in the ladder. And when he went to Crystal Palace after leaving City, you know, you're thinking, okay, his chance to redeem himself, and far from that happened. And, you know, Big Mal, as he was referred to in those days, his big ego and his big rep took a bit of a big hit. I just think, you know, it's a strange situation with Man City there. And once he took over, Joe Mercer, it seemed like it's not the same as Ferguson disappeared. It's not the same as Harry Catrick disappeared. But it's not far short. You know, the head of the club, the guy who was sort of deemed to be the chairman of the board, as much as, you know, in a large company, a figurehead is possibly the phrase, had gone, and it seemed a bit sort of weird afterwards, and they never seemed to pick up from there. And Everton had a similar situation with Catrick, as you mentioned. Man United were suffering a similar situation since from Matt Busby. So yeah, I think Malcolm Allison had a bit of a reality check. It was wake up and smell the coffee, Mel.
I mean, it is a, you know, I don't know. It's a big personality era, Dave, isn't it? You know, they are, you know, such megaliths, these managers at this point in time, and the focus on them is being intensified by, you know, I think the egos as well, which you know, so you've got your Cloughs and your Allisons kind of being a very different kettle of fish compared to, you know, the Shankleys and the Bill Nicholsons. You know, Shankly very much kind of like a very confident character by all means, and never shy of a soundbite, but it never born of arrogance, I would say. But here's a Malcolm Allison who essentially walks away from a Manchester City side who are, what, let's have a look, they were around about mid-table at the point in time when he departs them for a Crystal Palace side that have just got their head above water, only to take them down, and it would get worse the following season. This is kind of like, I don't know, for someone that's so sure of themselves, you know, this is quite the blow to Alisson. He's never quite the same, you know, he's never quite the same character or, you know, manager again. I mean, yes, he takes Crystal Palace, a third division Crystal Palace, to the FA Cup semi-final in 76. You know, he does eventually return to Manchester City, but his best days are behind. I mean, this is still just a year on from having had the league title in the palm of his hand at Manchester City, only to sign Roddy Marsh and seemingly kind of like blow up.
I suppose this is the start of the era where footballers and then football managers are more in the same vein as pop stars. I mean, obviously George Best had begun that, I suppose, in the 60s and perhaps Peter Osgood and one or two others. But this is when it's really starting to be that same kind of thing. And Malcolm Alisson was always one of those people who had to believe his own myth, I think, and he had to create his own myth. And as Gary's just said, absolutely, he was a coach, he wasn't a football manager. And Dave Sexton, and we'll come on to Don Howe, sadly, in a moment, was very much in the same mould. You know, and there is a difference between teaching footballers how to play, not teaching them how to play, but, you know, helping them improve and getting the tactical set up right and all of those sorts of things. And then the stuff that the man manager, the, you know, the Shankly, the Ferguson, the Busby manages to get that extra few percent out of him by talking to him in the right way or upsetting him sometimes or making him, you know, making the players want to please the manager. And I'm not sure that Malcolm Alisson ever really had that, because he was just such a brash, you know, I know, in the same way as Brian Clough in a sense, but he didn't have that man management bit of it in the way that Clough did. I don't know quite what it was that made Clough work in that way, but Malcolm Alisson hadn't got it. And once that myth was punctured, I suppose it was punctured the previous season with the Roddy Marsh signing that blew Manchester City up. I'm not sure that he ever believed himself again for all that all the bluster that you got whenever he was on television and he was always still doing the punditry and all that. I'm not sure that he believed himself anymore. I mean, Crystal Palace. Why would you go to Crystal Palace from Manchester City? You know, with all due respect and all of that stuff. But, I mean, even then, Manchester City were on a different planet to Crystal Palace. There was no reason to make that move. Okay, they were having a poorish season. They were mid-table, all of that. But, you know, lots of teams have that here and then they come again. I'm not sure he believed that he could do it again at Manchester City at that point, and that's why he went. And as I say, he never really showed again that quality that he'd shown in the late 60s under Joe Mercer. And I think that's the point. He needed Joe Mercer in the same way that Don Howe needed Bertie May.
I mean, Gary, it is a fascinating landscape that, you know, the concept of Alisson under Mercer, where, you know, they couldn't do anything wrong, and then, you know, the two part ways, and Mercer actually has a fine time of it with Gordon Milne at Coventry City, really, at least on a comparative level to what Coventry could achieve. You know, would have that caretaker manager spell in charge of England between Ramsey and Don Revie. So, you know, there would be a kind of, I don't know, a renaissance in that respect for Mercer. But Alisson, you know, you look at him against his great contemporary in Brian Clough, and we spoke of kind of like the trajectories that Ipswich and Wolves had as clubs at this point. It's almost a similarity between Clough and Alisson in that respect. You know, Clough heads to the stratosphere, whereas Alisson just kind of like meanders on downwards and, I don't know, an unsatisfactory plateau, really.
It's a recurring theme this season. I mean, it might be other seasons, but sort of, you know, talking about and this season, it's happened, seemed to happen so many times. And I guess Clough was a little bit different to the situation, Alisson, in as much as he was the manager and the coach as well. He didn't work under anybody. I mean, he'd probably argue he worked under the chairman of the club that he was employed at, but that's a different story. But it's strange, isn't it? And that sort of part in the ways. And it's a bit sad when, you know, a guy like Malcolm Allison, who had got all this sort of bluster about being, you know, the coming man and all this sort of thing, and it just fell away. It quickly got exposed as being beyond his ability. It's a bit like when Howard Kendall left Everton and Colin Harvey took over. There again, a coach doesn't necessarily make a great manager. I mean, there's a sort of metaphor in teaching. If you're a great teacher, you get promoted, and you stop being a teacher, they make you a headmaster or a headmistress, a head teacher, in which case you're not a teacher anymore, you're an administrator. It just seems crazy, and that's the same thing that happens with football clubs, and we talk about, you know, the situations here, where a coach doesn't necessarily make a great manager. It's not the same job. It's not like a step up on the ladder of the same job. It's a different job, and, you know, we talk about people here who've been given that step up and have been exposed because they hadn't got the ability to do the job that was different to the one that excelled at.
I mean, Dave, you've thrown in Don Howe to the conversation there. I've managed to hold off for an hour from talking about the demise of West Bromwich Albion this season. Crystal Palace is a peculiar one who go down alongside them. You know, they beat Man United 5, infamously beat Manchester United 5-0 at Selhurst Park. Earlier in the season, the result that precipitates the sacking of O'Farrell and the arrival of Doherty at Old Trafford. Yet they still slink to relegation. But West Brom, I think for me, given the casualties to come in terms of relegation across the 1970s, that Chelsea would go, that Manchester United would go down, that Tottenham would go down, Wolves, you know, you have to throw into that hat. So, you know, we've just spoken about how pertinent of a club Wolves were in the first half of the 1970s, yet would before relegation by 76. West Brom kind of set this trend, really. No, 1972-73, they are just 5 years on from having won the FA Cup. But, you know, you can kind of see the plot line across the previous seasons to this impending doom of 72-73. But even then, you've got to throw into the hat as well that this is still only 3 years on from them having played in the, you know, a League Cup final at Wembley as well.
Well, you joined me at an auspicious moment because, funnily enough, I've just started writing, this very day, I've started writing a book about Albion in the 1970s and also the wider thing about what Albion in the 1970s says about the game. It's a very strange thing, really. I mean, they won the League Cup in 66, got to the League Cup final 67, won the FA Cup in 68. Got to the FA Cup semi-final 69, got to the League Cup final in 1970. They lost that League Cup final to Manchester City, and Jim Gaunt, the Albion chairman, a proper black country bloke, industrialist, went into the, I think he was in the dressing room afterwards or on the coach on the way home, and he said, "Well, bugger this, I'm fed up of going to bloody Wembley. It's time we won the league." Now, Albion haven't been to Wembley since in a proper cup final, so, I mean, he's had half his wish. But a year later, we appoint Don Howe, and Don Howe has, of course, just won the double with Arsenal. And Don Howe played for the Albion for 10, 12 years, a couple of hundred games, 300 games, whatever it was. So he was, you know, a big figure at the Albion. And in fairness to Jim Gaunt and the Albion at that time, it was a proper ambitious move. You know, you would think that this is a golden thing to do. You know, get Don Howe in, he's the bloke, he knows. And it was a disaster from start to finish, really. I mean, he came in on his first day. My God. He came in his first day of pre-season training and said, "We're going to make the blue and white shirts as famous as the all-white of Real Madrid." Still waiting. That hasn't happened yet. He wasn't a man manager. The players, I interviewed Don about this at one point, and I've interviewed all the players who were there at that time. And he couldn't have worked any harder. I mean, he was, you know, the proverbial first one in, last one out, watched every game he could. But the players couldn't stand his training, and they just hated the way he went about things. Now, in part, this is because that's where football's changing at that point. I mean, Albion in the 60s, Jimmy Hagan was up and at him. You attack, 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 and that was it. It wasn't a great deal of thought about, you know, any tactics or anything like that. We had a couple of wingers, and they get down the flanks and knock the ball in the middle. And Jeff Astle had edit in. That was it, really, you know. And if he didn't edit in, Tony Brown was coming up from midfield and he'd volley it in, so we were fine. And Dono was starting to bring in stuff like that. And they, he made them eat pasta in 1972. Can you believe what a terrible thing? And they were having prawn cocktails for the pre-match meal because, you know, because it was going to give them more energy and all that kind of stuff. And they wanted their steak and chips. So there was a bit of a revolt about that. And then he would get the back four and he would tie them together with rope so that in training they had to stay within their distances from one another and he couldn't go, you know, somebody couldn't go belting off up the pitch and leaving the others behind. And the players could not stand it because this isn't what they did. They used to go out to the pub in Hampstead, Gary knows where Hampstead is, on a Thursday night for their pint and a game of darts and some dominoes and they'd have a chat about Saturday's game and then they'd play. And that was how football was, per se, in the 60s, and continued into the 70s. And in fairness to Darnell, he was trying to bring science and tactics and all of that sort of stuff to the game. And the players weren't having it, and the fans weren't having it either, because Albion were certainly at home. Albion were a cavalier team; they were absolutely hopeless away from home. But at home, they could murder anybody. You know, they would score threes and fours, and that was what people wanted to go and see, and Donne was having none of that. I mean, you know, we weren't caught offside for two seasons because nobody would go over the halfway line. That was how Albion played, and it was never be afraid of a nil-nil, that kind of stuff. And nobody liked it. Believe me, nobody liked it. The first season started pretty poorly, and then they had a bit of a renaissance in the second half of the season and got out of trouble. But that second season, it was just falling off the cliff. And Tony Brown, who went on to own every record at the football club, he's got a statue outside the ground now. And Tony Brown, even at one point, was thinking of leaving the football club. And weirdly enough, from Crystal Palace. And that was just the way it was. I mean, he wanted to turn Albion into Arsenal. He wanted to play up front with Jeff Astle up front and Tony Brown playing off him. And Tony Brown was a midfielder. He scored all his goals from midfield away. Steven Gerrard did, or Frank Lampard did, or Martin Peters did. He couldn't play with his back to goal, and Donnell wanted him playing with his back to goal, and Jeff Astle winning the headers and him playing off him, and nothing worked. Another one of the difficulties, I think, was that because he'd played at the Albion, some of the players that he played with were still in that dressing room. So Bobby Hope, for instance, was still in the dressing room. And during the Arsenal stubble season, he tried to buy Bobby Hope from the Albion. As soon as he got to the Albion, he sold in the Blues because he didn't want somebody in the dressing room who he'd been with as a player. So every element of it was wrong. But that relegation season, I mean, they were crap. They lost 4-0 at home to Crystal Palace. I mean, if that's going to happen, you might as well jack it in, haven't you? Really, at that point, you've got no hope in a season where Crystal Palace were terrible as well. But it was a seismic shock because I'd had 25 years in the First Division. Pretty much in straight after the war, they'd got promoted. I think two, three seasons after the war, and they'd been a fixture in the First Division. Nearly won the double in 1954, as you say. They'd won all those cups and been a top half side. And then from there, he got rid of good players and brought in kids, and the kids weren't good enough. And you know, when you replace good players with players who aren't as good, you can guarantee the results aren't going to be as good either. And that was what happened. Let's draw a veil now, shall we, over this great...
I'll throw the floor open to Gary here. I mean, they are a big casualty at this point in time, aren't they? They are kind of, you know, we mentioned of the relegations to come and you know, and it becomes quite jaw-dropping, just the victims of relegation from the First Division throughout the 1970s are almost as shocking as some of the FA Cup winners. You know, it has the moniker of being the Savage 70s, and this, you know, it was savage in terms of the victims of relegation. Even though, you know, you were a year away from Southampton being relegated, they finished comfortably mid-table this season. This is the last season of two up, two down as well. Three up, three down would come in for 73-74. But now West Brom, this was quite the relegation. This is only a year on as well from Nottingham Forest relegation. You know, Forrest had been in with a vague shout of the double in 66-67. So, it's a certain run of relegation for big teams that is quite stunning.
It is. I mean, I've got a great soft spot for the Baggies. I mean, like my wife, who's a Wolves fan, who's sort of laughing hysterically at listening to this. I've got a friend who used to go watch the Baggies pretty regularly with when we had the Roman era. It's interesting to see Dave say about. I didn't know that quote. That's a great quote about Don Howard turning up and saying we're going to turn the blue and white shirts into the white shirt of Real Madrid. Well, actually, turn the blue and white shirt into the white shirt of Walsall. By the sound of it, rather than Real Madrid. But yeah, it's you know, falling through the trapdoor out to the top tier was a bit of a perilous exercise. You know, we might touch on later Huddersfield, who this in 72-73 got relegated from the. From the second tier, after getting relegated the year before from the top tier, Crystal Palace, who went down with the Baggies, ended up in the third tier as well. So it was a sort of, if you're not careful, you're going down with a ball and chain tied to your legs to drag you straight through the league. So yeah, I mean, and Don Howe was. It's interesting. It's fascinating to hear Dave talk about the things that Howe did there. And in modern terms, they're perhaps not that weird, but it must have been a massive culture shock. You know, if you go in there and you want to change things, don't go and sort of say, you know, everything you've been doing is, it's a bit like the Brian Clough at Leeds, you know, everything you've been doing is wrong. Here's the new way that's going to solve everything. And the players are going on your bike, Tiger. That ain't happening. And you immediately, you know, before you've got a chance to win the dressing room, you've lost it. There's a lot of big teams that sort of fell through that trapdoor. And as I mentioned, you know, if you're not careful, it's an easy one to go straight through, as Palace did afterwards, and Huddersfield did this season as well.
I mean, great points there from Gary. You know, it is that fine dividing line between, you know, a big club being relegated and falling down the spectrum to the ones that fought the way back. You know, there is very much, but for the grace of God, really, for certain clubs. You look at Huddersfield and how massive they were, only to fall down, you know, a Manchester United who you know, would be relegated a year later, bouncing back, you know, that could have been their fate. You know, it's such fine lines, Dave.
We've said before, momentum is such a huge thing in football. Momentum is not always a positive thing. It can be going in the opposite direction. It's very easy to, particularly, I think, for a club that's been used to being in the first division for a long, long time, to then suddenly find itself away from all those trappings of the, you know, going to Anfield and going to Highbury and going to Old Trafford and all of that. And all of a sudden you're going to Blackpool again and you're going to, you know, maybe Albion played York, I remember, a couple of seasons later in the second division and they played, you know, Bristol City down there and I think Bristol Rovers possibly. Yeah, teams that they hadn't played for donkey's years. And we're only ever used to play it in the FA Cup or the League Cup or something, and I think that knocks you about a bit because you're suddenly in a much harsher environment, not such good teams as when you play in the, you know, the Liverpools and the Manchester Uniteds and the Chelseas and whatever, but a harsher environment in terms of, you know, the crowd is on top of you. They want the scalp because you've just come down from the first division there. You know, you're their big game for that season. They want to beat you and all that sort of stuff. I think it can take teams a while to find their feet again in that division. And Dono had two more years at the Albion in the second division where they never really looked like they were going to get up. And again, from today's standpoint, it seems bizarre that Albion just let him have his 4-year contract and then got rid of him and just by not renewing it. I mean, nowadays he'd have had the push, but as Gary was saying, you know, Sunderland that year finished 15, 16 points away from promotion, and Albion were going down into a division that had got Sunderland in it, who just won the FA Cup. So when you were going down, you weren't necessarily going down into a division full of mugs. You were going down into a division full of good teams with good players. It could be difficult to cope with that sometimes.
Indeed, indeed. And Gary, another team that would befall this fate a few more years later, 4 years on yet. For Tottenham Hotspur, but they win their last trophy under Bill Nicholson with the 1973 League Cup. They narrowly defeat Ron Saunders, Norwich City in the final. Wolves reach the semi-finals of this competition as well. You know, there's another nod in the direction of Bill McGarry. This is a Tottenham side that are still playing reasonably good football. You know, it's a fantastic season for Martin Peters individually. You know, amongst it, he scores four at Old Trafford. an absolutely majestic display of team and individual football. This is still a Tottenham side that boasts Pat Jennings, Joe Kinnear, Cyril Knowles. There's Alan Gilzean's in there, Mike England, the future Wales manager, Steve Perriman, Martin Chivers, Martin Peters, Jimmy Pearce. Ralph Coates is the substitute who wins the final for them. This eighth place in a cup, a respectable season for Tottenham, but it's the last of the halcyon days, really. There would be a UEFA Cup final a year later, but by 73-74, the league inconsistencies really take hold. And this is kind of like the last season in the sun as such for Tottenham at this point in time.
It's interesting, Steve, you say that you're right. You're absolutely right, mate. And Nicholson was a year away from leaving. This was last season for Ron Greenwood. Catrick was almost on the way out. Last but one season for Shanks. So there's a lot of big behemoths, managers who were on their last sort of season or two here. And for Tottenham, when Nicholson left, it's a bit similar. You can say for some of the other clubs as well. Once he'd gone, they sort of struggled to find that identity again. I think it was they lose the final of the Europa Cup to Feyenoord. Was it Feyenoord the last
year? Yeah, a year later they'd lose to Feyenoord.
Yeah, and he got really hacked off with the vandalism, apparently, in the hooligans. Yeah, it's a place. It's almost like a changing of the guard. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't. And not only is it sort of some of these big managers moving out, but there's a lot of coaches. And Dave just described the perils of employing a coach as a manager, Don Howe. And I said a similar thing happened with Sexton, a similar thing happened with Malcolm Allison. And there's perhaps two or three others who are going to bring to mind at the moment. But it seems such a massive change, as you say, a churn of the people managing, coaching, organising, running, bossing these teams and these clubs. So it is a massive turnover, and some teams cope with it far better than others, and some teams have real perilous times.
I mean, the opposite side of this, Ron Saunders, that's quite an achievement in taking Norwich to the League Cup final, Dave. He would become a man in great demand across the following seasons. Soon Manchester City will come knocking for him. And then off to Aston Villa, where he has his best days, really. But I think for everything to come for Ron Saunders, and this is the first of three successive League Cup finals with three different clubs as well at the helm for Ron Saunders. This is kind of like a big step in the direction of where he's going to take his career, isn't it?
You're talking to the wrong person about Ron Saunders, because he's slightly less popular than Don Howe at the Army.
I tried not to mention his West Brom days. We'll leave that for the 1980s series.
Yeah, I shall draw a veil over that one as well. it was a great achievement, actually, that season, because he kept Norwich in the division, because they were one of the teams down the bottom there with Albion and Palace. And I think probably the 8-9 games out, they looked the favourites to go down, Norwich. They looked in real trouble, and they managed to get their way out of it. And I mean, it was a really decent team for that period. David Cross up front, who went on and actually played for the Albion, but won the FA Cup with West Ham. The incredibly suave Kevin Keelan in goal. I was watching some highlights of this game earlier on, and two or three times he made a good save and then immediately got up and patted his hair back into position. I don't think Ralph Coates did. They got Graham. Grant Patton was a good player. Dave Stringer was a good player. So they were putting together a decent side. But Ron Saunders, he's the antithesis of that sort of Don Howe kind of thing. Because he was obviously a disciplinarian, Ron Saunders, and a strict fella to play for. But he got players to play for him, didn't he? Particularly later on at the Villa, those players would run through the proverbial cliche of the brick wall for him, which you wouldn't think from his outward appearance, but he was obviously a man manager who got the best from his players, and that was a real achievement there to get them. There would be greater triumphs for him to come. But it's such an interesting thing. You look at the the footage of that, and they look at the two managers there, and Bill Nicholson, he just seems so old. He just seems ancient. He's 54 at the time. And yeah, all those managers that Gary listed earlier on that were on the way out, they were all relatively youngish fellas, you know, but at the point at which they packed it up. And yet they seemed ancient. Now, I don't know whether that was a function of how people looked 50 years ago or whether it was that the game really did knock the crap out of you at that point compared to how it does now. But, I mean, you know, they seemed like they'd come down with the tablets with Moses, you know. I mean, they seemed like those Old Testament prophets that had had their day kind of thing. I suppose in that sense, Ron Saunders was the new generation coming through.
Indeed, indeed. One last thing as far as the First Division's concerned, it lost its they lost Gordon Banks, to a horrific car accident. He lost the sight of his eye. He would go on and play in the NESL, but as far as his career in English football was concerned, it was over, and sadly so. He got a rousing reception at Anfield when Bill Shankly insisted on walking him around on a lap of honour when they came to Anfield later in the season as Stoke City. Gary, Gordon Banks, this was a huge blow, not just to him personally, but to English football in general, and certainly to Alf Ramsey with the England national team.
I remember hearing about the news when it happened, and I'd be quite young at the time, and thinking, well, can he still play? And of course he couldn't, because the perception of depth, perception, all that sort of thing, they just sight in one eye. I guess you could look back at goalkeepers in different eras, but of that era, the sort of 6 or 7 years before, he was probably the best goalkeeper in the world, and it was a massive, massive blow to England, and as you say, to Ramsey particularly. Who was sort of a struggle at the time, shall we say. Lots of other things seemed to be going wrong. Yeah, I mean, a brilliant goalkeeper, a real tragedy.
Dave, he was enjoying a bit of an Indian summer. I think he was about 36 at the time, given that goalkeepers, Dino's off on the World Cup, so what, 41-year-old World Cup winning captain. He could have feasibly carried on at a high level for a number of years still to come. He'd won the League Cup with Stoke the previous season. He was in rich vein of form at the time as well.
He was. I mean, he was still unquestionably England's number one goalkeeper. No doubt about it at that point. And obviously, Clements and Shilton were coming through as kind of young pretenders, but there was no talk about Gordon Banks sort of stepping aside for England. He was still he was still one. I remember, like Gary, when it happened, and there was a lot of talk about Colin Milburn, the cricketer, because he'd had a similar accident about, 6, 7 years before, perhaps, in the mid-60s. And he'd come back and played a bit of cricket, hadn't he, at that point, but again, never at the absolute top level. And the idea that Gordon Banks was gone was just, it was one of those things you couldn't believe, it was impossible. Poor old Alf, he must have been. I don't know. I mean, the two great games that ended Alf Ramsey were West Germany in 1970 and Poland in 1973, and both of them Gordon Banks was missing. And if Gordon Banks had played in both of those games, England had probably won them both. That was the quality that he was. So
it is food for thought, isn't it, Gary? I mean, I think we'll come to the infamous night at Wembley in the next episode. But, in June 73, it's the trip to Chorzo. It's the 2-0 defeat where Bobby Moore is winning his record, 106th cap at that point in time. It's Lebanski. It's all of that. Shilton twice beating at his near post. I think the goals, you look at those goals, and I'm with Dave, obviously, I'm going to appear to have a bias here, and probably do. But, I think a right bias that Clements was far, far better than Shilton ever was. But Gordon Banks, you look at those two goals in Chorzo, and I'm looking at goals that I'm thinking Gordon Banks isn't conceded.
I think there's many things about that situation. I think Banks had an aura about him as well that Shilton hadn't established, obviously, when he took over in goal from the great man himself. But, yeah, it's... Yeah, you look at those. I mean, good point Dave made there. The two crucial games that sort of destroyed Ramsey, really. Banks wasn't available for either of them. And would he have been, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think he would have made the difference. It's a big call, that is. And, yeah, even at 36, when he retired, you know, the pretenders to the throne were still the pretenders to the throne. There was no, there was nobody sort of going, you know, you're always going to be out next game, or you're having a laugh. You're having a laugh. I mean, I remember when Benetti played in the 70 World Cup, he'd been his understudy for, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. And I think he had played six games. That's how dominant Banks was. And when you lose somebody like, when you lose that sort of stalwart, and it's interesting, just thinking as Dave was saying there, I mean, I remember the 66 World Cup a little bit before then. So for the time I was growing up watching football, Gordon Banks was England's goalkeeper. I mean, that was it. That Gordon Banks was England's goalkeeper. They will deal with the rest of that afterwards. So it was a big, a massive thing for England. And as I say, that aura he had about him, Shilton was a long way away from establishing. I don't know if he ever really did establish it in the end. As to Clemens and Shilton, I think, you know, they're two different types of goalkeepers, and, you know, they all had their pros and cons, and Clemens made a few errors as well. I mean, I remember the one from Dalglish that went through his pegs in the England-Scotland game at Wembley. So, you know, it's as long as it's broad. But I don't think either Shilton or Clemens were as good as Banks.
Moving away from Gordon Banks and all things First Division, we'll just rattle through some of the other instances of the season. Burnley and QPR convincingly promoted from the second division. As Gary mentioned early on, Huddersfield suffered a second successive relegation when they dropped to the third division, alongside Brighton, who within, well, 7 years would be back in the first division. It was only a very, very, you know, intriguing bun fight between 17th and 21st position. They were separated by just 2 points. You know, a hugely competitive relegation battle, far more competitive than the promotion race, which was very much monopolised by Burnley and QPR. Bolton and Notts County promoted from the third division to the second. Notts County, this two promotions in a short space of time in the decade-long rise from fourth to first division. Rotherham, Brentford, Swansea City and Scunthorpe down to the fourth division. Rotherham only down on goal average. Halifax, Watford and York survived them by the skin of the teeth. Southport promoted as fourth division champions just 5 years prior to being the last team to be to lose the re-election process and lose the Football League status, which we'll come to later in the series. Hereford, Cambridge, Aldershot all promoted. Crewe, Colchester, Northampton and Darlington all successfully gained re-election. For them, you know, breathing a sigh of relief given that Barrow and Bradford Park Avenue have recently lost league status. Dave, any standouts there that pique your interest?
I think particularly the teams that went up from the second division, Burnley and QPR, because they went up and they proved to be really substantial teams, didn't they? Over the following few seasons, I mean, Burnley got to the FA Cup semi-final the following year, lost to Newcastle in that one, and then QPR. That was the coming of that really strong QPR team, the Stan Bowles, Jerry Francis, Dave Clement, that would go on and push Liverpool close for the title in 76. So, you know, they were both really substantial teams that came up. And, you know, that underlines the point we were making about, you know, Sunderland. There were lots and lots of good players in the second division at that point. And teams that came up tended to, you know, to be more than competent when they got to the first division level. And, you know, you go down the division below that. Bolton came up that year, and then I think it was... Well, it was 75-6 that Bolton were on the way up into the 76-7 rather, that Bolton were on the way up into the first division themselves. So there was a lot of teams on the move there that were getting things right, but particularly those two that came up and QPR especially. Yeah, they went on to be they burned brightly and burned out pretty quickly, but I mean they were a pretty special team for 3 or 4 years.
Gary, anything from that list of down the divisions that piques your interest?
Yeah, a couple of things. I mean, it's interesting about QPR and Burnley. I mean, they had a nice defensive record. I mean, Burnley only conceded 35 goals in the entire league programme. That's seven less than Liverpool conceded. So, you know, I mean, how good was that? And just at the other end of the table, Brighton conceded 83 goals in 42 games. So you're almost starting 2-0 down on average in every game. So it's not one of those, they ended up bottom of the shop, as it were. Just on the fourth division, Hereford finished second, and they were promoted from the fourth division. The first season of football, as a football league club, they'd been elected to football league the year earlier, despite only finishing second to Chelmsford City in the Southern League. But they had beat Newcastle in the FA Cup that season, so they got them elected, and they got promoted the first season there. So that's a notable achievement for sure. And interestingly, the team that finished 20th, Hartlepool, here we are 50 years later, and I think they've just dropped out of the Football League.
Indeed they have. And our usual nod in true football-focused fashion, north of the border, Celtic champions again, but only narrowly. You know, Rangers give them a good run for the money this season. And they are beaten in both domestic cup finals. Rangers see to them in the Scottish Cup final, and it is Hibernian in the Scottish League Cup final. Dave, a bit of a testing season, this one for Celtic, compared to the ones that have preceded her.
Yeah, it went all the way to the wire there, didn't it? You know, just one point in it. 93 goals for Celtic, 74 for Rangers. Of course, Rangers that year lost Willie Johnston to the Albion, just bringing it back. The one thing that Donohoe did that was great, my all-time favourite player, Albion player, Willie Johnston. So that, obviously that made the difference. That's why Rangers didn't make it. I mean, they were 5 years then into the nine in a row, I think, Celtic. So they were, even though they dominated Scottish football for such a long period, at that point, it wasn't the same kind of domination that you've had in recent times when they had the nine in a row, and now when they're, is it two or three in a row, that two in a row that they've had now, back up there where they've just been streets ahead. I mean, quite often Rangers, Aberdeen would run them close in the Scottish League Division One. And I wonder if maybe, yeah, there's talk up in Scotland about whether they should go back to that idea of having an 18-team league, because Celtic don't, you know, Celtic and Rangers then aren't beating the third place team four times and creating a huge gap. And yeah, I can see the logic in that. I think your problem is, of course, by the time you get to February, there's about 10 or 12 teams in that division playing for nothing at all. And then you've got problems with gates and whether it's worth putting games on television and stuff. But it was even though Celtic were dominant, I think it was a healthier competition at that point.
And Gary, you know, this is a fine performance by, and as Dave said, they lose a significant player there, but to push Celtic so close, this is a year on from them having won the Cup Winners' Cup. So, you know, there is a bit of a spring in the step. You know, they gained a bit of revenge in the Scottish Cup final. You know, to finish a point behind, you know, is a fine performance. Derek Parlane scores 27 for them this season. Quinton Young scores 17. You know, there is goals in this side. Alfie Kahn, who would play on both sides of the Great Glasgow Divide, via a spell at Tottenham with some wild hair going on there, Alfie Kahn, as the decade progresses. This is an admirable season from Rangers.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's interesting. It's the centenary seasons for the Scottish FA. And it's interesting that the three teams that finished 1, 2 and 3 in the league table were actually shared the trophies. So Hibs finished third, although there were, you might argue that Fresh Air was third because they were 11 points behind Rangers. But it's interesting. I mean, I don't know how many seasons this has happened in Scottish football where three different clubs have won the three trophies. I mean, it's an interesting one. You know, the diversity of sort of sharing the trophies about that perhaps is much less prevalent of late.
Indeed. And at the foot of the table, it was Kilmarnock and Airdrie who suffered relegation. Airdrie quite convincingly. Kilmarnock just a point behind Dumbarton. But yes, you know, Hibs, a fine season for Hibs as well. Yes, a distant third, but, you know, third and winning the Scottish League Cup represents a fine season at Easter Road. And just one final nod to the end of the season. Gary, Ajax win their third successive European Cup. And yeah, it is kind of the zenith for Ajax.
It is. It's probably the best campaign, but the worst final. They beat Real Madrid. They beat Bayern Munich, both who were champions of their country, and then they beat Juve in the final, champions of Serie A. But the final was a dreadful game, played in Belgrade in coruscating heat. Ajax scored in the first 5 or 6 minutes, Rep's header, looping header, and from that stage, basically, it was like a stroll. Juventus didn't want to concede again and hope to get one in the break, and Ajax basically stuck the ball up the jumper and played at half pace because that was sufficient. I mean, a sort of real anticlimax to, you know, the third triumph when they'd beaten. The campaign was the best campaign, but the worst final. But three successive European champion trophies, and the best team, best club team in European history, as far as I'm concerned.
And Gary, I believe there is a book that you can be plugging for us at this really big opportunist moment.
Oh, you little tinker, Stephen. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, my book, The Dutch Masters, focusing on those three Ajax triumphs, is out now, available on Amazon. Just plug in my name, Gary Thacker, or type in Dutch Masters, and you'll find it there. And it's one of those stories that needs to be told, and told from the heart.
And a fantastic, fantastic book it is, I can vouch for.
It is indeed.
Yeah, a really, really wonderful book. But yes, thank you so much. That was 1972-73. Join us for episode 5, which will take us quite obviously on to 1973-74, and a magical season in so many respects. I said with a little bit too much glee. Dave, a wonderful episode, 72-73,
though. It's been good fun going through all that. I mean, it was just such a... Again, there's so many things happening during the course of that season, a lot of pivotal things, you know, particularly, I think, in terms of Liverpool really cracking it in Europe for the first time. I mean, that would obviously go on to be increasingly significant over the rest of the decade, but some great stuff to remember.
And Gary, have you enjoyed the episode?
Yeah, magnificent, mate. You know, as Dave mentioned, you know, it's great looking back at some of these sort of events, and now we know how they sort of shaped out afterwards, and you can sort of see the trailers for what was going to be the main events coming up. So, yeah, great fun, mate. Always happy to talk about football with mates, and a bit of reminiscence. Wonderful.
Brilliant stuff. And one last thing that we usually do at the end of these episodes. Gary, what is your 1972-73 go-to image? What is it that sums up 72-73 for you?
I guess it's Bob Starker running across the Wembley pitch to shake Jimmy Montgomery's hand.
Magnificent. And Dave, you feel free to take something from exactly the same game. I wouldn't blame you at all.
Well, it would have been Jim Montgomery's side, but let's be different. It's Kevin Keegan's header in the Borussia Mönchengladbach, one that set up the win in the Anfield leg. That was an indelible image of the year, I think.
I think so. I think all the more alluring for David Coleman's commentary as well in that one. And going back to Larry Lloyd is the often forgotten scorer in that game, and a crucial penalty save as well for Ray Clements, amongst all that too. But brilliant. Thank you so much, both of you, for a wonderful episode. All I've got left to say now is please join us for episode 5 as we go into 1973-74. Magnificent FA Cup final performances, record-breaking unbeaten runs from start of seasons, and heartwarming relegations. There's everything at our disposal for episode 5. Please join us next time on These Football Times 1970s Odyssey. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.